Coming up, Randy Roach and Dr. Frank Barnhill.
It's the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And now, here's Jimmy.
Hey, and welcome back to the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore, episode 493. Today we have with us, coming up first, a gentleman by the name of Randy Roach. He is the author of a book entitled Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, and there are several volumes to this book. This guy is a fitness expert, anything and everything to do with the subject of bodybuilding, and he could probably tell you about it. His website is randyroach.ca, and we'll look forward to hearing from him here in just a moment. First, I wanted to tell you about our sponsor. It is Quest Bars. Here's fitness model and Quest Bar spokesperson, Rachel Mack.
So I have been obsessed with Quest Bars since I first discovered them, and I had never heard of them before. I saw an ad on a website, and I looked at the website, and I thought, there's no way these bars are for real. And I just immediately bought two boxes. I was like, even if they taste terrible, I love the numbers on them. So I ordered a couple boxes. They were gone in a few days. I ordered some more boxes, et cetera, and they really kept me sane when I was prepping for my first competition. They're a small company and they're great people, and everybody is really interested in health and fitness, and they're great. They sent me a little good luck video before my second competition, and we have a really close relationship. So I've had a lot of fun with them. And of course, I'm still obsessed with their bars, and they have three new flavors that are amazing. The mixed berry is my favorite. What's your
favorite?
Mine
too. That's mine. Now, Christine, my wife, loves the apple pie, but,
the
mixed berry is da bomb. I mean,
yeah.
I love that.
Did you try the peanut butter and jelly?
No.
Oh.
Well, oh, wow.
You're going to have to call them up, and they released it as a prototype. It was fantastic.
How about that? And I'm waiting on the one, the all-natural one. They're taking the Splenda out on the recommendation of people like me and you and said, hey, some people out there don't like artificial sweeteners. Can you make one?
Right.
There's going to be a version of the Quest Bar coming out very soon, Quest Bar Natural. Yes, you heard it here first. And it's going to be amazing. I haven't tried it yet, but if they make it taste even close to the original with the Splenda, it's going to be really, really good.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Visit questproteinbar.com/freebars to get two free Quest bars.
And now here is a brief interview with Randy Roach. Welcome back to the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And today I am pleased to welcome to the show a gentleman by the name of Randy Roach. He is a retired computer programmer, spent over 15 years developing systems in both the museum and environmental engineering professions. He's written and published books in different fields, three different fields. He now makes his living as an author and private health and training consultant in his home in Ontario, Canada. He can be reached through his website, and he's got a really cool website you definitely need to check out. It's at randyroach.ca, and once you're there, you will notice that Randy is quite the prolific author of a series of books, three volumes of a book called Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, which we're going to talk all about today here on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Well, tell us a little more of your backstory, because you have a really fascinating story about how you got into the fitness world and got so interested in the subject of bodybuilding and healthy nutrition. Tell us about it.
Well, I've always been interested in bodybuilding ever since I was a little kid. And going back in the early 70s, when you saw some of the television programs, bodybuilders weren't as prevalent on the scene as, say, today, but you still got a glimpse of them here and there, such as Dave Draper. And I was interested way back then, and I was always, like, building benches and wooden benches and gadgets and stuff. So I was there from the beginning. And even in the late 70s, I got more interested in the nutrition part of it. And through the 80s, the nutrition part picked up more than the bodybuilding, because I was losing my eyesight and I was looking for answers in that route. So it just so happens that I've made a lot of decisions and tried a lot of things in terms of nutrition that some were good for bodybuilding, some were bad for bodybuilding.
Right.
And I've always been into working out and building my own equipment, and to the point where it just manifests and built right through up to the later 90s when I really started seriously getting commercial equipment and looking to have a serious home-based gym that I have now, which is about a 1,200 square foot commercial gym in my home.
Wow.
I like to make a correction. I've been published in three different fields, not written books in those other two fields. I've only written the mirrors in the bodybuilding arena.
Okay. Well, so how did you lose your eyesight? Was that a genetic thing?
No, I had Stevens-Johnson syndrome when I was two, and it's like a violent reactionary syndrome, and it caused problems most of my life, but I had some levels of vision all the way up until 2005, in January 2005, it all went, right in the middle of writing the book. But subsequently, I've got some of it back. Excuse me. I was totally blind for a couple of years where I had to use speech software and have people read to me, all those things to adjust, go all to keystrokes on the computer. But I have received some eyesight back where I don't always have to use my white cane. And so it's working and training people that way.
Wow.
So it'll always be a struggle for me. So I intend to get more back. So I just got to be patient and keep working on that.
Well, and some people would say if something like that happened to them, Randy, they'd say, well, I guess that's it with life. I can't really do anything. But you've taken just the opposite approach and said, hey, this information that I know, losing my eyesight isn't going to stop me from sharing that.
Well, I had my moments. I was frustrated. I was throwing books around. But during the period when there was times where I had closed circuit TVs and trying to read one word at a time and just banging against the screen and throwing the book, and I was thinking of quitting a couple of times. Like, it wasn't this big heroic effort. I was surrounded by really good people, worked for a good company that helped me gracefully bow out of computer programming and get into being just specifically a writer and a trainer. It was a process. And I had time to prepare myself to lose my sight. You know, 20 years ago, the thought of losing my eyesight scared the hell out of me. And so by the time it did happen, it wasn't as big an impact as it could have been. But like I said, during that process, I had my moments of thinking about, why am I doing this? I could just sit back and do nothing.
Yeah.
But I am a stubborn person, and I really wanted to do the book and get it done. And I had good people encouraging me and working with me.
Sure. So let's talk about your books, because you have a series of them, Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, Volume 1, 2, and 3. The first one is a very humongous book. Volume 1 was like 562 pages, but you really kind of get into the history of bodybuilding. Where did it come from? Why did people become so fascinated by it? Can you kind of tell us some of the history of bodybuilding, where it started, and what the nutrition looked like for those early bodybuilders? Because it was vastly different than what we're doing today.
Totally different. Clarify another thing. Only Volume 1 is available right now.
Right.
That was released in June of 2008. Volume 2 will probably be a little bit bigger, and it's going to be hopefully released later this year. And it pertains 1970s, where Volume 1 went all the way back and came up to the closing of the 1960s.
Okay.
And it's more of the history, primarily the 20th century, but I go back further just for some entertainment purposes. Mm-hmm. It could go back a couple thousand years and dealing with Hercules, Samson, but I come through and I pick it up in the 18th century, but it really picks up and at the turn of the 20th century with a gentleman like Eugene Sandow, who was a world-class strongman, good-looking guy, and an exhibitionist at the turn of the century. Bernard McFadden, who's considered the father of physical culture, because at that time, they were referring themselves as physical culturists. Physical culture at that time was actually just kind of another word for sport. It had various meanings. Today it has different meanings. I kind of give it my own meaning. But the athletes at that time who were lifting weights, they were calling themselves physical culturists. And there was kind of a split in the types of training back then. Bernard McFadden was more of a fanatic. He did a lot of exercise, a lot of walking, and in terms of he did some weights, but he wasn't a big strength performer like Sandow and the Saxon brothers, who ate totally different. And what I did in the book, I compared the works because these early bodybuilders call themselves physical culturists. They naturally align themselves with the alternative medical field, the naturopaths, the homeopaths, the chiropractors, as opposed to allopathic medicine or drug-based medicine that we know today. So they were fairly knowledgeable in well-being, good health, and exercise, and good eating. And but in that group, there was a split of how they ate. And it lined up uncannily with a couple of the primitive tribes, the Hunza that were studied by Dr. Robert Carrison, and the Eskimos studied by Vilgamar Stefansson. And the two diets were really mirrored the early two bodybuilding templates, with the Eskimo having a high protein, higher fat, much lower carbohydrate, some with more moderate carbohydrate, where the Hunza ate two meals a day that was primarily agrarian based, with some milk and some tiny amounts of meat. And that basically how Bernard McFadden ate. And the Saxon brothers and Sandow eat more kind of in that Eskimo model, the higher protein and fat and moderate carbohydrates. And it's really bizarre how many followed in Bernard's tracks and how many followed in the Sandow. Now, most of them ate in the terms of bodybuilding, ate with the higher protein, higher fat model through the whole first 70 years of the 20th century. It was only when the vegetarian and the cholesterol scare came in that the model started to switch a little bit in the late 70s, and especially in the 1980s with all the fat hysteria, that the vegetarian-based model started to pick up. But back in the 50s, the word bodybuilding started to show up around 1910, but they were still calling themselves physical culturists. Even in the 1940s, Vince Gironda, who was one of our bodybuilding pioneers, was calling himself body culturist. But it was starting to be replaced slowly by bodybuilders when the Mr. America started up seriously in 1939, 1940. That's when modern bodybuilding really started to take shape, even though it's been held some physique competitions where Charles Atlas, so everybody has probably heard of Charles Atlas, who had won Bernard McFadden's event back in 1921. So, but it was the first 50 years, it was primarily exercise, fresh air, whole natural foods. And they weren't afraid of proteins. The carbohydrates were actually kept quite a minimum. It was fruits and vegetables, proteins, meat, eggs, milk, and very little amounts of like potatoes and some rice, but it nothing like when the 80s and the 90s were that it totally flip flop where everybody was going 60 to 80% carbohydrate.
So, Randy, I'm curious, when we made the switch in the bodybuilding world from a more protein and fat based diet to one that was compromised primarily of carbohydrate and still exists today, you must carb up if you want to perform. And I mean, it's so strange how we've kind of done this total 180. Was there any performance changes that happened as a whole when we switched the diet to that, or did most bodybuilders who were really tried and true in the sport say, that's nonsense, I'm going to stick with what I know works?
A lot of them were challenged. You got to remember, we didn't have the information highway back then. Many of them were going with some of the research, guys like Vince Gironda and Real Blair. They were trying to mitigate, monitor what was coming onto the scene in terms of information, and a lot of it was BS. And they had no choice but to get suckered to a certain degree. But some of them who weren't getting mired down in a lot of the research stuck to their guns. Our man Tanny, he was a raw food eater, a raw meat eater, all the way back from 1940s, and he never switched anything from what I understand. Gironda basically turned a little bit, but then switched back quickly. Real Blair, he stuck with it. They Ron Kossoff, who runs NSP Nutrition, he said back then he knew his grandparents, his adoptive grandparents, were eating like six eggs a day, large sandwiches. They were 98, 100 years old. He said that it didn't make any sense to him at all. It was, as far as performance changes, no, you can't monitor that because what took over was anabolic steroids at that time. So you totally skewed the whole monitoring service for checking, okay, was this diet, did they suddenly change to go to a high-carb diet and the performance is improved? Yeah, the performance is improved because the amount of drugs they were taking went through the roof. So that's almost impossible to to judge and to ascertain how much tooth is there. But I know with the bodybuilders from the 50s and 60s, they built a tremendous amount of muscle eating proteins and fats. And from my personal experience and personal opinion, you can't eat that same amount of calories and carbohydrates, you can get fat, because now you're dealing with insulin and not controlling insulin properly. They understood how to control insulin. They knew that carbohydrates could create a mess. I won't say that Dr. Mauro Di Pasquale, he was studying insulin back in the late 60s, when he was a pretty advanced med school student, but most of the bodybuilders couldn't get into the biochemistry of insulin in the 60s, but they understood it from experience. They would just say, it's better to come in a little bit under carb, because too many carbs, you're a mess, you know, because even putting water in the wrong places. But I myself can eat twice as many calories and proteins and fats than I can with carbohydrates. Well, I will get fat. But they knew this through trial and error back in the 60s and the 70s. But what they did in the 70s is they just dropped the fat right out. And so you just basically got a high carbohydrate and moderate to high protein with, and in order to get a low fat diet, it's very difficult to do that naturally. So you had to go with supplements and protein powders and right. to get the fats down, because you can't get beef and eggs and dairy unless you're going into skim milk, you're going into egg whites, and that diet has no historical precedence whatsoever. And it was a big gamble. It was a big experiment, and it's, in my personal opinion, it was nonsense.
So the protein powder industry that is like so strong today probably would have never existed had it not been for them eliminating the need for meat and eggs and some of the natural protein sources that bodybuilders way back when used to consume regularly.
Protein supplements and bodybuilding came out of industrial waste. The first was soy protein back in very 1950. Urban Johnson, he later changed his name to Real Blair. He was in Chicago. He's considered one of the pioneers of bodybuilding nutrition. He's a smart guy. And he called the miracle food, but he called protein the miracle food. Bob Hoffman, who ran York Barbell and developed American weightlifting dominance to the 20th century, he jumped right on that. Well, the first 50 years, 40 years, Bob was promoting whole natural foods. But, you know, they found out that these protein powders and supplements, you just sell one barbell and you just lost yourself a customer, because they don't need to come back. Steel lasts a long time. But they found with the supplements, it's a renewable, you know, it's sustained. It has to be sustained. So you're back. You got customers coming back monthly. This was a financial boon to these guys. So they jumped on it huge. And Hoffman just started promoting soy as the be-all, end-all, the real staff of life, where Blair immediately dumped it. He didn't like soy, but he was promoting protein as the big thing. But at that time, in the first 50 years of the 20th century, soy was primarily considered an industrial product. It really wasn't in our food supply. They were using it for separating the oils and getting the grease in the paints, and they're just basically burying the meal into the ground or feeding it to animals, and they shouldn't have been doing that either. But somebody got the bright idea, anytime you get industrial waste, let's make money. Instead of spending money to deal with it, let's make money and sell it to the American public and make them eat it. So that was what happened, and they started selling the protein meal as a protein supplement. But there was problems with it, because hydrogenation was just started. The oils naturally in soy would become rancid. And Hoffman started out with a full-fat soy, and his product could become rancid. He had to keep it in the fridge, where Real Blair went with the defatted. It was not actually defatted. But then you had to go through all the processing involved to get all the fat out, and you really had a beat-up product by that time. That's why Blair dropped it, and he went to a milk and egg protein out of the Wander Company out in Villa Park in Illinois, and he became known like that. He had this mysterious milk and egg, magical milk and egg protein through the 60s. He was charging huge bucks for it, but he promoted to mix it with milk and raw milk and raw cream. He became a real advocate for raw milk and raw cream to mix his protein powder with that, because he probably knew that's where the real nutrition was. But he seemed to believe in his protein powder and the supplements that he did. He stuck with it, and he actually left the bodybuilding field and catered more towards the Hollywood crowd when he moved to California in 1958, and later in 1970s, kind of shifted away. But the protein powders, as soon as the powders came in the 1950s, all the articles started to change their tone. It was suddenly protein this, protein that, because everybody's making good money now. Before you were selling courses, you were selling some equipment, some photographs, but the protein was, it just blew all those other commodities out of the market for value, because they made a lot of money. They made a lot of money off of it. So the whole scene, the whole tone, the whole atmosphere of bodybuilding began to change, and they started to make it all supplement oriented. Even the natural food guys, like Perry Radar, who ran Iron Man magazine through the 20th century, he got into it too, but he wasn't buying into it at first. In fact, either were Bob Hoffman and Joe Weider at first, but because they thought, you know, you get it from food, but they started to buy in. You know, our soils are becoming more depleted, and our food supply, which was true, our food supply was being seriously compromised, but they thought they could magically fix it with supplements. And I think we've been fooled to a great degree there as well, where supplements have their place. I don't think we've ever put the proper money in to really ascertain how effective they are under what circumstances. Are there circumstances where they interfere with your nutrition and health? Are there circumstances where they help you? That could be determined. Dr. Rob McCarrison, who worked with the Huns, as I mentioned, early in the 20th century, Sir Francis Pottinger, Dr. Francis Pottinger,
right,
in San Francisco. He worked with cats and a number of subjects where McCarrison worked with rats. They weren't people, but at least they took their subjects through gestation periods, pregnancies, to see the compromise during the developmental stages when you're basically compromising the diet, and really showed problems. And I think there's lots of money out there. I just don't think there's any real desire to run these studies to really show where they're beneficial, where they're harmful, or what the truth is there.
Well, and you bring up a good point regarding, you know, the prevalence of all these supplements and protein powders. I mean, all you got to do is walk into your local GNC store to know what a huge moneymaker that whole business is. So you're exactly right. They're not interested in actually looking at what would be most effective, Randy. They just want to keep making money.
No, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars a year, just
yeah,
from some of the big companies. And the hype, see, here's what's happened, and here's what is really frustrating, because the industry does not police itself, and the way it governs itself, it doesn't govern itself. The way it runs itself, it screams for regulation. But anybody who knows anything about who regulates anything, whether it's Health Canada or the FDA, we don't trust them to regulate, because they're basically owned by the pharmaceutical cartels, and they don't want the competition anyways. But that's the problem that we're in today, that the supplement industry needs to be monitored, because a lot of these guys are actually spiking their supplements to get an initial bang, so people say, wow, this thing really works. And that is reprehensible. It can mean to be doing stuff like that, but they do it. And just because they know that their supplements by themselves typically don't work.
And it happens more often than not.
Yeah, not to the extent that they like you to believe. I went through all this. I'm 52 years, going to be 52 years old. I've been training, and I was selling protein powders back in the 1990s, thinking whey protein is really great. We finally come to the conclusion that this is, again, whey protein, most people don't know, was another industrial waste. It was a hazardous industrial waste, because they weren't even allowed to dump it into the waters because of the lots of fermentation process. I guess it caused some interference. It's not that whey itself, real whole natural whey, is bad, but whey from the cheese industry, the way they're disposing of it, was not ideal. And again, it was another thing that was a waste product at first, and then it was thrown into our market. But again, it's a food fraction, and we're taking it in large amounts. It's been pasteurized, it's been processed, and it's been separated from a lot of its other cofactors and synergists. So we don't know for sure exactly what this stuff, if it's degenerative long term, because what those factors and cofactors that have been taking out of it, you know, for our body to process and assimilate it, how much of it does it have to leach from our tissues to basically do that? Bernard McFadden was pointing this out 100 years ago with white bread. He said, you're better off to eat nothing than to eat the white wheat, because all the cofactors and synergists, the minerals, the essential fats and vitamins that were in the germ are gone. They're all a part of the process of just assimilation of the wheat. And if they're not there, your body has to leach it from its own tissues. So it's long term, it could be very degenerative. See, you don't eat a piece of white bread and drop over dead. So you think, that's nothing wrong with this. But 15, 20 years might go by and wonder, well, hey, I got arthritis. So, I got this condition or that condition. And you can't figure out what it was. It was a long, slow degenerative process. That's what's happened in the 20th century with our diets, where we basically replaced infectious diseases with degenerative diseases. Some are more acute, but some are more long-term. Mm. Lots of money did Mayoff treating them too. So we're just a symptom-based culture where everything's treated with drugs. And
I've had many people on this show, Randy, who have talked about the pharmaceutical industry and that very thing. It's, oh, you know, you've got high cholesterol, just take a pill for it. It'll lower naturally. And really? That's natural?
Yeah, we're starting to do the same. But we're starting to do the same thing in the alternative field. See, it used to be back in the, like I said, the first 50 years, it was the alternative field against the allopathic or the drug-based. And the alternative field really promoted good diet, good solid diet. And but when they too fell into the trap of when they saw the supplements come along, that, hey, we can dispense these in the same way the pharmaceuticals dispense drugs. And in many ways, we started in alternative field, started shooting at symptoms as well. As where I say, like, obviously, it's much safer dispensation, right? We're dealing with the products that aren't going to be nearly as harmful to, say, as drugs, but a lot of the preventative got pushed, not all of it, but some of it got pushed aside because there was a lot of money for it, even in the alternative medical fields, for them to make money off the supplements because they had no choice because, like, up here in Canada, we have a socialized healthcare, but it's monopolized by pharmaceutical. So you can go to your doctor and get free healthcare, but he's not going to prescribe vitamins or anything. He's going to prescribe drugs because that's the pharmaceuticals that are behind it, the whole thing. So the alternative physicians, the naturopaths, homeopaths, they need to make a living. So obviously you can't just tell anybody to change their diet, help me change, you know, set up a diet plan for them because they're not going to last very long in business. So the supplements are a big part of it. They do believe in them. But again, they've come to dispense them in often in the same manner as the way the allopathic doctors do.
Sure.
So then now the alternative health field is split because those people are going to primarily with food and those versus who use a lot of supplements. And there's probably a nice middle ground somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And but where is it? That's the whole thing.
So, Randy, what is, in your opinion, the perfect bodybuilder's diet?
Yeah, for bodybuilding, I would say as raw as possible. I mean, raw meat, raw milk, raw eggs, everything, as much as you can. Because the way I've seen it work with people, the way that effect on me. It's like I said, back in the 60s, a lot of the guys did do a lot of raw milk, did do a lot of meat. Not all of them were eating it raw. They were cooking them, but the amount of food they ate. We don't eat that way anymore. And I just tell people, like, okay, eat as much raw as you can psychologically handle.
What's the purpose in that of making it raw versus cooked?
But the food's still alive. It's a big difference. Like, I mean, when you have to actually experience it and try to compare how much you can eat. I can't eat the same amount of food cooked as I can raw. There's definitely a denaturing process in terms of altering the structure. Like when you take an egg, it's raw, it's liquid. When you cook it, it's congealed. Now some argue, well, it's better to basically be digested that way. No, not necessarily. Any of the things I read when coming into the raw food, I thought, come on, it's nonsense. You know, raw milk will work this way. Raw cream will work this way. Raw butter. Well, I said they're all the same thing. Well, until I actually experienced it. Raw foods have a strong role to play in detoxifying the body, and it is uncanny how it can pull things from the body, even stuff like coconut oils and when you actually juice them yourself, and creams, butter, raw cheese is how they pull. And again, I didn't believe it until I actually tried it. Raw meats, I don't feel much. I could eat a half a pound of raw meat and continue without blinking because I don't feel it there. It breaks down. And even meat that's aged with bacteria, we're finding out now that the stomach, where you've been lied to for the past 150 years about germs and bacteria, just how important our stomach intestinal flora is in terms of our immune system, our digestive system. We told E. coli, like I said, all campylobacter, all these things are bad for you. They're going to kill you. But E. coli is a big part of, amino acid production, vitamin K, vitamin B, certain B complex vitamins. And it's a huge part. Without this proper flora, we're dead or in big trouble. And they're, even with autism, they're finding out that there's a seriously compromised intestinal flora with autistic kids, and they're getting great results by trying to rebuild that flora. So with raw foods, it just goes right, it fits right in. Like, I mean, even like I said, even age, it just breaks down. The raw eggs are digested very quickly. Where I can't drink raw milk. I mean, sorry, I can't drink pasteurized milk. I never could, but raw milk, I can drink as much as I want.
Yeah.
You got to try and experience it and get the feel. I've had some advanced bodybuilders put on 20 pounds in 6 months, and these guys who are a natural bodybuilder in particular, it's just different until you actually try it. I believe food we have rapport with it from an energetic point of view. It's biologically alive, and I think it's information. And the less you cook it, and the less you process it, the less you garble that energy and that information. And people disagree with me. And I say, look, people are living long and healthy lives when they cook food. That's why I say, don't eat anything you fear. If you fear raw foods, don't eat it. You're better off just to be grateful and be happy with the food you have. But
sure,
at least make it whole and as natural as you can. Like this packaged up processed stuff is, you know, it's done a lot of damage.
Oh, a humongous amount of damage. And we've heard about this for many, many years. I think about the passing this year of the great Jack LaLanne. And the cultural impact that he made for the sport of bodybuilding for the common person, not the competitive people, but just the everyday people. And I remember seeing some of his old video footage on YouTube, Randy, where he's, eschewing people eating processed foods and eating sugar and different things like that. What role do you think he played in this whole game?
Well, I just did a radio show on when Jack died, and on and did a show with Dan Lurie. Do you know the name Dan Lurie?
I do.
Dan was one of our pioneers in bodybuilding, and then he ran bodybuilding shows and competed with the Weeders. And Dan knew Jack, so Dan and I were guests on a show to talk about Jack. Jack was phenomenal. Another bodybuilding friend of mine, Boyer Cole, he was a champion bodybuilder in the 70s. He went to listen to Norman Vincent Peale, an inspirational speaker, and he said it just so happened they lined up to see he was going to go see Jack LaLanne about a week or so later, and he said Peale couldn't hold a candle to Jack. And when you listen to Jack, he's just full of that energy. He was part of the muscle team back in the 1930s, and he basically was converted to stop eating the junk food by Paul Bragg, who was another kind of physical culturist of the 20th century. And Jack was inspirational in his energy, the fact he opened the early gym in the 30s. He helped develop some of the equipment. And he competed in some bodybuilding shows. But then he ran his show. He was on television from the 1950s right into the 80s. But just listening to Jack, and he knew just talking about being happy. He said, why isn't anybody happy? He goes, you got to be happy. And he just knew the secret to well-being. And I believe the definition of well-being and good health is happiness.
Yep.
Because I don't think you can really be fully, truly happy if you're not healthy, physically, mentally, spiritually, everything. So that, to me, the bottom line definition of good health and condition, everybody say, oh, yeah, how much are you running each week? How much are you lifting each week? It doesn't matter. How happy, truly happy are you? That is the definition, I think, of real true health. Good health. And Jack had that. He had that. He seemed to be a happy guy, and he talked about happy, being happy. And so I really got a kick out of him.
And he certainly exuded that happiness throughout his career. I think that's what helped him live a very long life, and that cannot be underestimated, what that attitude brought to him. In addition to his physical fitness and the way he ate, I think that general attitude of optimism and happiness really carried him on into his 90s, and he lived a long and healthy life.
Yes, he did.
Now, there's somebody else that also impacted the sport, which you get into in your Volume 2, the upcoming book that will be available. Again, we're talking to Randy Roach. Visit his website, randyroach.ca, and in Volume 2 of Muscle, Smoke, and Mirrors, you get into Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is probably the world's most famous bodybuilder of the modern times, that is. Impact did he have? Go ahead.
Arnold had – I'm writing on that right now, as you said, and the bylines for this second volume are The Pumping Iron Years, Nautilus Emerges. You got to remember, it just so happened that my first volume ended with the closing of the 1960s. That was actually quite a crucial turning point because we were just about to enter the era of Arnold. Arnold was just coming over from Austria at that time in 1968. It was the dawning of the explosion of the fitness industry. 1968 was the year Kenneth Cooper wrote his book, Aerobics. So the culture was going to change significantly in the 70s. Two men, Charles Gaines and George Butler, were going to write and film a movie and book called Pumping Iron. And Arnold arrived on the scene at a great time. And George and Charles, I think, were significant working with Arnold. And Arnold had his own charms. He was an outstanding bodybuilder, and he was a big guy. And just the climate was there for him. At the same time with that fitness industry, weight training was going to start to take off. And during the 1970s, Arnold wasn't huge in the media in the 1970s outside of bodybuilding. Within bodybuilding, he was the new king. He was an Iron Man, muscle builder, power, strength, and health. They had to acknowledge because he was Mr. Olympia from 1970, 1975, again in 1980. Now, Pumping Iron, the book came out in 1974 and started to permeate into the culture outside of bodybuilding. But it was the movie in 1977 that really launched Arnold, but it didn't launch to huge audiences. It wasn't actually until the very early 1980s that it really started to really get out there, and Arnold, then his movie career started to take off. So it was actually in the 1980s that really blasted Arnold into the mainstream public outside of just bodybuilding. And by that time, the fitness industry was just booming at that time. The equipment industry exploded. Nautilus was developed by Arthur Jones. Arthur Jones is a part of this second volume because he came in the scene in 1970, revolutionized the exercise equipment, went head-to-head battling with Universal. You remember the Universal machines that were in all the YMCAs, and that was a bitter fight. And just dealing with it now, I didn't realize how the lawsuits that were going on and how bitter it was. But by the time the fitness industry was in full swing in the 1980s, anybody looked at a machine thought, oh, you got a Nautilus, whether it was a Nautilus machine or not. That's how much of an impact the Nautilus name and Arthur Jones had on the industry. In my opinion, just as big as Schwarzenegger. It was Arnold's movie career that really elevated Arnold to the popularity he has today.
Right.
But if you confine him just to bodybuilding and to the fitness industry, you have to say that Nautilus and Jones had just as much of an impact in a way. And there are other characters behind the scenes. A lot of stuff going on. The Weeders, when the smoke all cleared, it was the Weeders that came out on top in the 1980s who kind of took control of bodybuilding, and they made millions off the supplement industry, millions off the magazine industry, millions off the equipment industry. I believe they sold their equipment component of their corporate web there for about $350 or $370 million in the 1990s. A lot of money. I think the magazines went for pretty close to the same thing about another 6 or 7 years later, and he still hung on to the nutrition part. So that's the kind of money that the fitness industry started generating by the 1990s. Because my third volume will be on the 80s and 90s, and that's
right.
I really want to keep it to just three volumes and move on to something else.
Now, Randy, when did this become so mainstream that we had all these gyms pop up all over the place? I live in an area in South Carolina. There are literally four gyms within a couple of miles of my house, and that didn't used to be. We have things like the Gold's Gym now and some of these local mom-and-pop gyms. When did that happen?
What was also going on in the 1970s when the gyms started to really proliferate was, the health scare, the cardiovascular disease scare, heart attacks and strokes. They were never telling us the truth as to what was really going on behind the scenes, but we thought we could cure it all through exercise. Exercise is an important component, but not nearly as important, in my opinion, as nutrition. But that being said, that was a huge part of the explosion as well of the popularity of physical fitness. So, yeah, jogging took off, but so did the gym environment. Okay, now it was suddenly cool to work out. And same with there were a lot of actors through the 1950s and 60s who were bodybuilders behind the scenes. Charles Bronson, Clint Walker, William Smith, these are fairly recognizable actors who were at Vince's gym working out. But a lot of them didn't say anything about it because it wasn't a cool thing to do. But by the 1970s, suddenly now you got Clint Eastwood on the front of magazines in his home gym working out. He's got making movies. They all got their shirts off. So body image, you know, Bo Derek, so she redefined how we scale ourselves when she made the movie 10, right?
Right.
So the whole culture became really body image conscious. So everybody had to be buff. That was where the new keywords coming in. Like, you know, getting lean, ripped, and, you know, Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Dolph Lundgren, Jean-Claude Van Damme, all these action heroes playing in the movies in the 1980s, everybody wanted to work out. The gyms just started exploding, and they were opening up all over the place. The franchises taking off, Gold's, World's Gym franchising at that time. You know, like you said, a lot of the local gyms proliferating, and that's how that happened. It was just a growing awareness of physical conditioning and look. It was both. The look became acceptable, and it was under the belief that it's going to improve your health. And obviously, exercise does improve your health. But so that's those two double whammy throughout the gym. Proliferation as we see it today.
Now, it seems like most gyms, though, Randy, these days tend to focus mostly on the cardio and not so much on the bodybuilding. Yeah, there's weights there, and there's definitely training and trainers to train people on the weights. But it seems like the focus these days, and it could be the biggest loser syndrome, is all on the cardiovascular equipment. Was there a shift that happened there, or has cardio always dominated over bodybuilding?
Cardio, you can probably say, going back to Kenneth Cooper and his aerobics and the running craze, probably always had the edge. Yeah, a lot of money is made off cardio today, probably much more money than actual weight training equipment. And again, it is money that drives the industry. Not necessarily truth. Arthur Jones back in 1975 showed the outstanding results he could get using weights and moving in the circuit in a fast manner for flexibility, strength, and cardio. In fact, he claimed to have produced a cardio effect that could not be duplicated in the aerobics field. So that's why you're also seeing a resurgence in what's called HIIT in terms of the high-intensity interval training. For more anaerobic training, because it does get the cardiovascular and it builds muscle. It's muscle you want that makes you strong and keeps a healthy metabolism. And so more and more people are starting to understand that. But you're right. Most of these gyms have cardio. A lot of people don't mind sitting on a machine, going at a steady state pace and not breathing too hard, watching TV or listening to music or reading, where you can't do that while you're training. If you want to train seriously, build muscle, and that's what makes your body change. It's muscle. It's not when I say cardio, I'm assuming you're meaning aerobic
yes,
based,
that's
slow,
right.
Steady state, not because I get cardio out of my weight training. So I look at it differently, but
right.
Aerobics can be as antithetical to weight training. It can take muscle off. You can start remodeling certain muscle fibers. And again, I just tell people, if that's really what you do enjoy, then do it. You know, do
yeah.
it. Don't do it because you're making to do it. I look at some people and they just do not gel with weights or machines. They're just not going to keep it up. To do it. So I tell them find something else that makes them happy that they will do. And they'll go do cardio. But like I said, you know, it's mostly that cardio so you can do money, profit, because they make a lot of money off the cardio equipment.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've heard talking to some people in the industry that some of the big corporations are actually giving away some of the weight training equipment just to make the cardio sales.
Wow.
So it is a big business, equipment industry. And a lot of people are now going into functional training. So the equipment is really advanced. The bodybuilding equipment, variable resistance. Arthur came on the scene and he brought along variable resistance. Most people don't even understand what that is.
Mm-mm.
Most people don't even understand why he created those machines and what they were supposed to be used for. Most people just jump on them, try to leverage themselves to lift as much weight as they can, as fast as they can, and they get nothing from it other than either damaging the machine. But they have a purpose, and they use it properly. They're very, very effective in They're tools, just like barbells and dumbbells and kettlebells and all different variations of equipment. They're all tools, and I just tell people, like, just move your body. You don't have to be a bodybuilder. Just be active a few times a week, four times a week. Do
right.
what makes you happy, and you can do it. And for me, it's always been weights.
Now, Randy, there's a movement happening as a subset of the bodybuilding industry, and it's this whole super slow lifting. When did that originate? Have you done any research on that, and do you see that kind of becoming a new trend, or is that something that's kind of old to people like yourself who have probably heard it for many years?
Yeah, it's actually really bizarre you asked me that, because one of my very good friends who's become a very good friend in the past 2 years is Joshua Trentini. He's a 2006 NGA Natural Mr. USA, mm-hmm. probably one of the smartest guys on the planet in terms of machines and variable resistance. He now owns the technology for that slow. He's called Renaissance, but the technology was started out knowing as Super Slow by Ken Hutchins, who worked with Arthur Jones from Nautilus back. Ken came on that scene late 1970s. Very smart guy, and he was really into the variable resistance and moving to a slower cadence. Now, I'm just learning the history of this now and the history of Ken and the technology that he and Joshua are developing right now under Renaissance. And I have become more interested where I used to actually criticize it, but I was pretty much ignorant myself mm-hmm. in doing it, because you can't just, people say, okay, super slow, go grab that little 10-pound dumbbell and go real slow. Well, that is not at all what's involved there. Right. And there's a lot to do to really make it really effective is the technology and the machines that they're building. And they're coming out with more newer machines, but these guys really have it down into the cam profiles and how to vary the machine properly to move at that slower cadence. And Josh is online lifting some really big weights at a very slow cadence. And he's been up in my place a few times, and I'm learning more. So I'm learning more about that. So he's the kind of guy you want to talk to about that.
Well, I'm gonna throw two names at you that I've had formerly on this show. One is Dr. Doug McGuff, and the other one is Fred Hahn. Both of those names are people you should know about as you do your investigation and research into that. If you want to learn more, they're definitely two of the leading consumer people that are out there that have books on this, so that you can learn more about it. But definitely worth looking into. And just was curious if you had any thoughts about the slow movement. So that's good. Now, in volume two, you also bring up, and we talked on this a little bit earlier, the biggest medical fraud of the 20th century. That severely altered the diets, not just of bodybuilders, which obviously had a humongous impact on the bodybuilders, but also the general public. And it's got to be when we move to this low-fat diet nonsense.
Yeah, definitely. It started off in the 1950s. They actually held a fundraiser to promote this new prudent diet of replacing lard with corn oil, eggs and beef with chicken, and just, it was all low fat. And I think it was Dr. Norman Jolliffe out of New York had ran a study that ran to 1966 that should have blown that thing right out of the water, because he had actually, I think he used medical professionals to, one ate this new prudent diet and the other one ate meat and eggs, or meat three times a day and then eggs. And after, I think, 1966, when they compiled the data, they said, yeah, the group eating more cholesterol and protein did have a higher natural cholesterol count, but there wasn't any deaths from heart disease. But in the other group eating the prudent diet, there were 8 died from heart disease,
wow.
heart attacks. So, I mean, that should have killed it right there. There was obviously politics involved here. And, yeah. you know, like I said, the Ansel Keys bogus study, and when you look at all the cholesterol, the LRC and MRFIT, these are all major studies over the decades that convinced them had to go to low-fat cholesterol and saturated fat were going to kill us with heart disease. They were all a lie. When you compile the data, there was never any evidence at all to correlate that. And basically, lots of money was made. Like in the late 60s, when Atkins came along, you know, he was noting that there was a political atmosphere that there was just not going to be no support for a low-carbohydrate diet. It was good. They decided somewhere on high that they were going with this low fat, and it come hell or high water. And they pushed our culture huge. It was a lot of money went into that campaign to push us into a low fat diet, because they don't like us eating the animal product. It's all to do with the globalization of the food supply, which I do and will talk about more in volume 3. Because understand what's happening to our food supply, the compromise of it, the loss of choice to choose supplements is being all orchestrated from the globalization process. And again, they were changing the whole dietary landscape of the Western world all through going back through the decades. And by the 1970s, they were literally convincing us that fat and cholesterol are going to kill you. And they didn't listen to Dr. Paul Dudley White, who was Eisenhower's personal physician and one of the pioneers of the American Heart Association, and who also introduced electrocardiogram to America. He didn't buy into it. He said, look, when I graduated from Harvard Med back, I think in 1911 or something like that, 1960, I'm not sure the year, he said, you never heard of a myocardial infarction. It was just when I think 1921 he saw his own first case. But he said, and that's when they were eating cream and olive oil might have been one of the only vegetable oils at the time. They were doing coconut and palm kernel oils, but lard, tallow, eggs. And he said, well, this wasn't a problem. Even Weston Price took the statistics from, I think, the New York Department of Health or something. From 1906, the mortality rate for heart disease and cancer was only 6%.
Right.
They knew what it was. It wasn't that we could diagnose it better later. That's nonsense. They knew exactly what it was. But by 1930, it had changed dramatically. It already moved to be almost the number one killer, up to 30% of the mortality rate. So what happened? It wasn't that our consumption of animal products went through the roof. In fact, they slightly went down. What happened was their consumption of vegetable oils, processed vegetable oils, and refined sugars, and actually God knows how many other chemicals that came into our diet over that three-decade period that started to change what was happening. But they just ran it. They milked it and they ran it, and it just exploded in the 1980s. That's when I fell for it. I was in my early 20s and early 1980s, and I thought, oh my goodness, a guy can't eat eggs, he can't eat meat. I became a vegan. I did a lot of damage to myself that way. You know, so it was called the anti-cholesterol education program or something like that. But it was all over the media. It was just absolutely all over the media about cholesterol. And it fooled a lot of people, including a lot of the bodybuilders who were pretty stuck in their ways. I follow the books. I was buying the books already in the 70s. Even the Weider publications, their book, they had the typical diet of proteins, fats, moderate carbohydrates. All of a sudden, 2 years later, they rewrite the book, and it's a totally different diet. It's all carbohydrate, low fat, higher moderate protein. Weiders always want the higher protein because they, of course, sold the protein powders. But yeah, the low fat diet came in, and they went ridiculous. They got absolutely ridiculous. They were trying to theoretically get to almost a zero fat diet, which was impossible to do, and they were running into all sorts of problems. Then some of the bodybuilders were starting to say, "Hey, well, this doesn't feel good. This doesn't feel right."
Yeah.
You know, a 10% fat diet, you can't get that out there in nature unless you're an absolute vegan, plant-eating vegan. But again, you're not going to build a lot of muscle that way. And it's people started to shift back. In the 1990s, some of it started to shift back.
Yeah.
To include more fats into the diet. And Mario DePasquale wrote a book called The Anabolic Diet, where he's talking about a high-fat diet, but he got crucified just like Atkins, right? Atkins got crucified in the early 70s, like this guy. You know, listening to him on television programs with, say, mainstream academia, say, from Cornell or something like that, they are just married to the calories, the calories, the calorie, calories in, calories out. And Atkins saying, no, it's not. By that time, you know, by the 90s, Atkins had zero respect for academia, and he would almost just yell at them to shut up right on the air. You know, because he was tired of listening to the rhetoric, right? That the old calorie. Anybody who works with a cross-section of the population as a trainer sees that a calorie is not a calorie is not a calorie. You can see some people, it does seem to work that way. The exercise, cut the calories back, with all the hormones working properly. Yep, it seems to work pretty good. But then you get a whole bunch of other people who just don't budge.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't judge on certain diets, and they shift and people call it, like myself. I can eat, I've eaten at sometimes up to 10,000 calories a day for 2 days in a row, and then maybe drop it to maybe 3,000 or 4,000 and still lost body fat. But if I substituted that macronutrient balance to have primarily carbohydrates, I would get fat very quickly because of the insulin. Because as soon as you put those carbohydrates in there, you're bringing out insulin. Insulin's the storage hormone.
That can be
very anabolic. See, in bodybuilding, they want proteins and fats, and they want to control their carbohydrates. They want to control their insulin. They understand insulin. Yes, it can be anabolic, but it can also make you very fat too.
Yep. His name is Randy Roach, and he is a very passionate speaker, as you can tell today, about the subject of what he studied for a very long time, and he's put in a series of books. One is available right now. It's Muscle Smoke and Mirrors, Volume 1, definitely go check it out at randyroach.ca. And later this year, we'll have volume two of the book, which will go into the impact of Arnold Schwarzenegger has made, the move of the political power from the Yorks to the Weeders, Arthur Jones, Gold's Gym. He really hits on a lot of those things. And then volume three, when's volume three coming?
I have no idea. Probably about 3 years. I'd like to get it out faster. I was 3 years between these volumes. I'd like to get it out faster. I'm more committed and dedicated to it. I already have material. Volume two was originally supposed to be the 70s and the 80s, but with Arthur, I had to cut it off. So I already have a lot of material in the 80s done. So I'm hoping to get that out quicker.
Well, they'll just have to check out randyroach.ca to see when those are coming. But definitely check this out if you're interested in the history of bodybuilding. And I think is more important how the nutrition has changed from what it was at one time to what it is now. It's definitely not the way it originally was supposed to be today. So definitely check out that history. And thank you so much for being here today on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show. Again, his name's Randy Roach. Check out his website, randyroach.ca. Today's second interview is with Dr. Frank Barnhill, but his patients know him better as Dr. Huggy Bear. Yes, he works with kids and is trying to help kids with behavior issues who most of the time are diagnosed with ADHD, but he has written a book that goes into great detail about why a lot of ADHD is misdiagnosed. He's got a book called Mistaken for ADHD, How You Can Prevent Mislabeling Your Child as a Failure in Life in the Face of a Looming ADHD Misdiagnosis Crisis. He lives just up the road from me here in South Carolina, and I wanted to bring him on because, quite frankly, a lot of people out there are putting their kids on all kinds of drugs for ADHD, and they may not need to do that. So you're going to hear why here in just a moment. First, I wanted to remind you about the Low Carb Cruise that is coming May the 6th through the 13th, 2012. We got a whole slew of people that are coming, and we'd love to have you come. We are filling up that boat just as quickly as we can, and it's going to be so much fun. We would just love to have you. LowCarbCruiseInfo.com if you want to learn more about it. And now here is a brief message about the Low Carb Cruise.
It's coming. The Low Carb Paleo Event of the Year. It's the 5th annual Low Carb Cruise, and you're invited to join us on board the Carnival Magic, May 6th through the 13th, 2012, featuring the biggest names in the low carb community, including Gary Tobbs in a rare public appearance, Rob Wolf, Chris Masterjohn, Dr. Jeff Volek, Dr. Andrea Seinfeld, Jackie Eberstein, Dr. Eric Westman, Monique Forslund, Jimmy Moore, Dr. John Briffa, Denise Minger, and many more. Plus, a very special low-carb roast of the guest speakers by Tom Naughton. This is a low-carb event like none you've ever seen, and you won't want to miss it. Visit LowCarbCruiseInfo.com for full details on what is sure to be the most talked-about event of the year. We'll see you May 6th through the 13th, 2012, on board the Carnival Magic for the 5th annual Low Carb Cruise.
And now, without further delay, let's get into my interview with Dr. Frank Barnhill. Welcome back to the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show with Jimmy Moore. And today I am pleased to welcome actually a guy that's just down the road from me. I live in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and he is also from what we call the upstate of South Carolina. His name is Dr. Frank Barnhill. He is a board-certified family physician, and he has practiced ADHD behavioral and family medicine here for nearly three decades. He is known affectionately, and I love this, Dr. Barnhill. You're known as Dr. Huggy Bear, because you hug all of your patients in your quest for the most feel-good, patient-oriented medical practice in the U.S., and you have a brand new book that people need to know about called Mistaken for ADHD, How You Can Prevent Mislabeling Your Child as a Failure in Life in the Face of a Looming ADHD Misdiagnosis Crisis. Dr. Barnhill, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
I've seen you locally on television on the local, what was it, Channel 7, the CBS affiliate. I've seen you on there a few times. And I said, man, I got to get this guy on my show. You really have established yourself as kind of a go-to expert when it comes to all things related to ADHD and the great misdiagnoses, which we will talk about here in just a moment. But before we get into that, tell us a little more about yourself. Why did you get involved in medicine and health to begin with, and when did it morph over to this interest in ADHD?
Well, I started in family medicine over 30 years ago because I knew that I wanted to have a positive impact on what we call the family unit. I wanted to be involved with children from birth all the way through their grandparents and great-grandparents, and I also realized that the trend in taking care of families was moving away just from general practice to more of a specific, specialized practice that one doctor was trained to do all of it so that he could do some surgery, could handle heart problems, liver problems, everything from the common cold to depression and psychosis. And I saw an opportunity to expand my practice to include treating attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, so I did. And about 8 or 9 years ago, while seeing dozens and dozens of ADHD kids a month, it struck me that I was seeing more and more children who were misdiagnosed with ADHD. In other words, they had come to my practice because maybe their mom and dad weren't satisfied that their ADHD medications were working. In many cases, what brought them into the practice or to see me was their grades were terrible. Mm. You know, mom and dad would show up and say, I don't understand. Dr. such and such put him on all of these ADHD stimulants, and instead of getting better, he's gotten worse.
Yeah.
You know, his grades are going down. His attitude's terrible. The teacher complains about his behavior all the time. And a lot of these parents were desperate. They needed answers. I mean, I had one woman that literally bought her daughter in and said, here, she's yours. Fix her and call me when you get her fixed.
Wow.
Because she, you know, the lady was at wit's end. She had lost her friends. She had lost family members, didn't want to have anything to do with her. The kid's behavior was so bad. This is a little 12-year-old girl. Her behavior was so bad and her attitude was so terrible that nobody wanted to be around her. This woman was being isolated. She was becoming ostracized by everybody. Her friends no longer invited her to come over. They didn't invite her to go shopping. No one wanted to sit beside them at church. You know, the family never invited her to go on picnics or do anything because the little girl's behavior was terrible. It was just terrible. And in her case, the child had bipolar disease.
Mm.
She was not ADHD. She had a mild form of bipolar disease. And every time a doctor put her on an ADHD medicine like Ritalin or Adderall or Concerta, her bipolar disease got worse. Mm. Because, you know, those are all amphetamines. They're stimulants. And a bipolar child already is a little overstimulated. You know, they're in hyperdrive. And it made her mind race, and her behavior got worse. So, of course, I helped the mom. She was desperate. She was just about to pull her hair out. She said, I'm at wit's end. I can't take anymore. The child had been expelled from school because of her behavior, and that was literally the straw that broke the camel's back. So I saw that more and more children were showing up in my office with the wrong diagnosis. They were being labeled as learning disabled, failures in life, the dumb kid, the daydreamer, the child who was hyperactive for no reason. And a lot of times I would take them off of their ADHD medications and they get better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, And I discovered more and more things that could cause them to act just like they had ADHD or could mimic ADHD. And the list became very long. Currently, there are over 60 things. Those are chemicals, nutritional deficits, psychiatric diagnoses, and physical problems that can cause a child to look just like they have ADHD. And I did a lot of research, went through literally several thousand articles and books over a period of about 6 years, and finally decided to write the book, Mistaken for ADHD, because I could see how we needed to avoid mislabeling even one child. One child's too many. Affecting one child's future adversely by calling them ADHD, learning disabled, or whatever, when they're really not. That's one child too many. I mean, my goal is to teach parents, educators, teachers, and other doctors how to make sure that the diagnosis is accurate, how to be absolutely sure or as sure as possible that the child really has ADHD and doesn't have one of these other things that can look like ADHD.
Right. Yeah, and you mentioned that in chapters 3 and 4, how to diagnose ADHD the wrong way, which is what so many general practitioners probably are using now, and then diagnosing ADHD the right way, which kind of outlines the template that you use in your practice. Tell us about what the wrong ways are. Why are so many doctors getting it wrong?
What happens, at least as far as I'm concerned, from talking to other doctors at medical conferences and to colleagues at the hospital, parents come in usually because of a referral from a teacher. The child's not doing very well in school. It's sort of a last-minute, God, let's save the child effort. And they come in and they basically say, fix him now or he's going to fail. You have got to do something immediately. Put him on that pill that the kid's on, you know, the one down the street from me who has ADHD. And doctors are pushed really hard. We're time limited. You know, insurance companies want you to see more and more patients and not spend a lot of money doing so. Parents don't have a lot of time. They have to take time off from work and from other things just to bring the child to the office. So there's a tremendous push for the doctor to treat the symptoms without adequately working up the problem. And usually that happens, at least I've found that it does. Doctors make some common mistakes, and one of those is thinking that you can diagnose ADHD in one office visit. They rarely get enough history from the family. They rarely get a history from the teacher. And see, it's very important because ADHD by diagnosis must impair the child's ability to learn and function in two different environments. That means the child must clearly show problems at home and at school, or at home and in social occasions, or at school and during athletic events, or, say, school and church, but in two different environments, two different surroundings. And I find that most of these children don't fit that criteria, that they don't have problems in two places. When they've been misdiagnosed, they tend to either have problems at school or at home,
yeah,
or maybe out in public. And there's a rush to put, you know, everyone wants to medicate the child immediately.
Yeah.
And the misconception is if you put them on an ADHD medicine, it's going to fix their behavior. Well, that doesn't work. ADHD medication is meant to improve attention span and concentration so that the child can learn while in the class and from his or her surroundings. And that's what improves the behavior, is the improvement in the attention span.
Well, and unfortunately, it doesn't get to the root cause of the problem, which you talk about brilliantly in the different zebras, the ADHD zebras, as you call them in part three of your book, at one of which is this whole issue of low blood sugar. I think a lot of people, Dr. Barnhill, if they hear blood sugar, they think, oh, that's for people with diabetes, but it goes way beyond diabetes.
Oh, that's correct. I mean, just think of it this way. Literally 50% of the medications that you can buy over the counter at your pharmacy or drugstore affects your child's blood sugar.
Wow.
It can either send it up or it can send it down. There are many more things than diabetes that create low blood sugar. Just a couple of weeks ago, I saw a 15-year-old young lady who had been diagnosed as ADHD. And we went through, I probably saw her three times, could find absolutely nothing that fit the criterion for ADHD, except she was inattentive and she was tired. And finally, I asked her to do a glucose tolerance test. And in the third hour of the glucose tolerance test, her blood sugar dropped to 40. Now, when your blood sugar is below 70, you can't drive, you can hardly walk, you've got slurry speech. And, of course, we had to give her glucose right away because she crashed. That happens in children even younger. The youngest that I have seen that had what's called spontaneous hypoglycemia, or that low blood sugar,
right,
was about 5. And those children can't pay attention.
No.
And when their blood sugar finally rebounds on its own, maybe an hour or two later, they become hyper because they're scared. They don't understand what happened when their blood sugar bottomed out. And as a result, they become fidgety, restless, won't sit still. And sometimes teachers send them in and say, I can't handle it. You know, his behavior is terrible. You do a blood sugar, and lo and behold, it's, you know, 60. You know what the problem is.
Mm. Well, and, you know, we're feeding kids more and more sugar these days, more and more refined carbohydrates. It seems to me that those might be, you know, playing a role in this whole thing.
Oh, that's very true. In the news briefs over the past 7 or 8 months, I have included several articles on my web blog, mistakenforadhd.com, that deal with fast food ingestion, the preservatives, red and yellow dyes, and all that stuff, because it's been in the literature a lot lately. Medical literature has covered a bunch of things that we now know, and for years I've suspected that would eventually be proven to cause behavior problems in children. And one of those things actually is the fact that most kids eat a lot of junk food.
Yeah.
They get all these preservatives, all these dyes. They get heavy carbohydrate loads. In other words, they're eating a lot of sugar. And while sugar in and of itself doesn't cause ADHD, it's just like when my kids were young. If you load a child with a lot of sugar, they become hyper based on the sugar. They have to burn it off. And once they burn it off, their hyperactivity goes away. They're not ADHD. They're just responding to all of that sugar load.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing's true with the junk food. Junk food is loaded with the wrong things. It's loaded with carbohydrates. It's not as high in protein as it should be. It's not high in vitamins and minerals and supplements. And all of those things are important when it comes to an ADHD child, and especially one that has a behavior disorder.
Right.
It's like sleep. A child who doesn't sleep well at night may act like an ADHD child the next day.
Mm.
And, you know, I tell parents the same thing. You need to feed your children a good, well-balanced diet, low in junk food. Make sure they get plenty of vitamins, fish oil supplements, all the minerals they need, especially vitamins B, 12, thiamin, and D, because all of those have been clearly shown, if a child's deficient in vitamin D, B12, or thiamin, they will have a behavior problem. I corrected a child's vitamin D about a year ago. In other words, this little boy came in once again, bouncing off the walls at school. We did a diet review on him. His diet was terrible. He had absolutely no milk intake, no cheese. He just didn't like it. His vitamin D level was almost non-existent. We put him on therapeutic doses of vitamin D, and within a month, his behavior was normal.
Wow.
Now, I mean, you know, that's a very simple thing to do. And my goal is to help parents protect their child's future, to keep them from being mislabeled and, you know, misdiagnosed and mislabeled as ADHD, because once you're labeled as ADHD, it follows you through life.
Yeah.
From then on, everybody that knows you says, oh, he's ADHD. He's going to have a learning problem. He's going to have a behavior problem. He has to take medicines. And if I can help parents correct their child's behavior by something as simple as diagnosing vitamin D deficiency and taking vitamin D every day,
right,
well, that's a great thing. I think that's wonderful.
Sure.
You know, the medications we use for ADHD, the stimulants, they have a lot of side effects. Headache, blurry vision, rapid heartbeat, stomach aches, muscle pains, weight loss,
yeah,
restless nights. I mean, there are dozens of side effects to these drugs. And overall, children just, they need a balanced diet. There's even an article on my mistakenforadhd.com blog that talks about how exercise helps behavior problem children. Just by engaging in organized exercise several times a week, a study that was published back in the fall showed that kids who had behavior problems actually improved by as much as 75% simply by having organized exercise.
Is it the endorphins?
I think it's a combination of burning up the carbohydrates and the endorphins and serotonin dopamine levels going up in the brain.
Yep.
Because, you know, one of the problems that kids who have behavior, that have a behavior problem have, is that their brain levels of serotonin, dopamine, and norepinephrine are all out of whack. They're not normal. They fluctuate widely, and that's what causes these children not to perform, you know, normally. They don't have normal concentration, and they can't inhibit those little things that cause impulsivity. In other words, you know, when you and I were sitting in the classroom, if the teacher said sit still, we were scared enough we sat still.
Yeah.
You know, but a child who's you know, brain neurotransmitters are out of whack, the serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine levels are not normal, that kid has very little control over what his mind says do.
Right.
You know, if his mind says, I need to fidget because I'm restless, that's what he does, because he can't seem to control it. And teachers mistake that.
Yeah.
They mistake that for, oh, that child's got to be ADHD. We have to fix it immediately.
So,
and that's what a lot of parents want.
So why are
the quick fix?
Yeah, I guess that kind of answers my next question. Why are parents and teachers so quick to go to a risky medication when it seems like changes in nutrition and supplementation are working for your patients?
It's because the medication will work within just a few days.
Yeah.
But changing a child's exercise habits and nutritional habits is going to take at least a month. And it's not a quick fix. When you're removing chemicals, all those things that we talked about, including pesticide exposure causes ADHD symptoms. Just having pesticides on your peaches, your strawberries, your blueberries, your blackberries can affect your child. So I tell parents, hey, you feed your child fresh fruit, be sure you wash it thoroughly, because if you don't, you're getting pesticide exposure. Your child's behavior problem may be coming from pesticides. It takes a long time and a lot of effort to do that. Which is faster, pop a pill in the kid's mouth or have to worry about washing everything, cooking natural, you know, foods, not getting the fast foods, not being able to throw it in the microwave, and making sure the kid goes to some type of sporting exercise event three times a week. The pill's faster, right?
Yeah, and yet people are so willing, Dr. Barnhill, to pop those pills in their kid's mouth, not knowing what the side effects really are going to be. They just know this is going to fix them, whereas they could use real food, get a berries from a local farmer if they're worried about the pesticide issue. I mean, there are a lot of ways. It just seems commonsensical to people that listen to this show anyway, that nutrition would be kind of the first thing that people would want to go to rather than turning to any risky drugs.
Oh, I agree. I think that what I ask parents to do is to be patient.
Yeah.
You see, a lot of the children that I see who are in their parents are in crisis mode, as I call it. You know, they're desperate. They want something fixed. Sort of like the lady that I mentioned that lost all of her friends, brought her daughter in and said, here, she's yours. Keep her until you fix her and call me.
Yeah.
They wait until the last minute to do something. Then they want something done immediately. And what I explain to them is usually the faster you try to treat ADHD, the more likely you're going to harm that child.
Mm.
You're going to hurt the child. The child is going to end up with the wrong diagnosis, on the wrong medication, have all the side effects of the medication. It's better to do ADHD diagnosis step by step than it is to try to do it like some doctors do in 15 or 20 minutes. You just can't do it. I can't diagnose ADHD in 15 to 20 minutes. And one of the other problems I see is most doctors don't even draw basic blood work before they start those medicines.
Wow.
They don't know whether the child is vitamin D deficient or B12 deficient. They don't know what the protein levels are. They have no idea what the iron level is. I check a lead level on all these kids because, you know, lead toxicity can cause ADHD problems.
Right.
The child may have been exposed to lead somewhere in an old house, eating paint chips or out playing near a landfill or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's important to adequately work up the child before you start the child on medication.
Are there any checks and balances on doctors prescribing these medications, that they take certain protocols in place? And if not, should they have that in place?
Actually, I don't know of any checks or balances.
Wow.
I don't know how you could put those into place because you don't have to be board certified in any type of medicine to practice ADHD medicine in America.
Mm.
In other words, it doesn't matter whether you're a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a pediatrician, a family doctor, a general practitioner, or whatever. You have a license to prescribe medicines. You can prescribe ADHD drugs.
Mm.
So, and, you know, I go to a lot of conferences and I hear the psychologists and the psychiatrists and the neurodevelopmental pediatricians talking about how hard it is to make the diagnosis, but I don't see a lot of emphasis on trying to train doctors to make that diagnosis.
Yeah.
Now, there are places throughout America that have started emphasizing that. Our own Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston has a really good ADHD instruction program, as does Duke, UCLA out on the other end of the continent. There are places, UNC, Chapel Hill,
right.
East Carolina, Winston-Salem, they all have really good training programs, and it's getting better. It's just that those are medical students, and it's going to be is, you know, maybe 5 years before they're out practicing medicine.
So right now, you're one of the few in America that's actually using these protocols that you've been talking about today for ADHD. Are there others? Is there some kind of network where people can access, who might be listening in another part of the country or even another part of the world, access, you know, physicians like yourself who are doing this kind of treatment for ADHD?
We are trying to put that network together. Right now,
awesome.
I know of fewer than 50 doctors
wow.
in the United States that actively believe that ADHD is overdiagnosed and misdiagnosed and are willing to take the training to learn how to do the, you know, the nutrition part, avoid the chemicals, and take the time to do a proper evaluation. So hopefully we're going to have that list available by the end of the year. It's just very difficult.
Yeah.
You have to understand, and I know you do, but most parents don't understand the cost of treating an ADHD child. Right now, this year, 2011, it cost approximately $19,000 to $20,000 a year to treat an ADHD child.
Mm.
That means that the money has to come either from the insurance company, taxes, out of the parents' pockets. It has to come from somewhere. And that's evaluation, therapy, drugs, special schools, special learning programs, special classes, you know, physical therapy, whatever it takes, speech therapy, to treat these children. It's expensive. And sometime in the next 3 or 4 years, as many as 12 million American children may be diagnosed as ADHD.
Mm.
And approximately 25 to 40% of those, between 3.5 and 5 million kids in America, will have been misdiagnosed with ADHD and will have been mislabeled and will be receiving the wrong therapy.
Wow.
And we, in order to avert both a medical crisis and a financial crisis, we have got to educate Americans about how to make the diagnosis of ADHD. And that's one of the goals in my book. Mistaken for ADHD was meant to be a resource. It's a guide. It's sort of like a parents, teachers, doctors, medical textbook that tells you what is and what isn't ADHD and how you can diagnose what isn't and how to diagnose what is and what to do about treatment.
Yeah.
And it's all in the book. And the reason that it has to be used, the reason I think it should be used as a resource is that there aren't currently any books out there, either medical or consumer related, that give you that intensive training, that insight into what is and what isn't ADHD.
Yeah.
So that's where we are today.
And I love the way, that's probably my favorite part of your whole book, is in the part three where you identify all the zebras, the diseases of the pancreas, the thyroid gland, various blood disorders, sleep disorders, neurological problems, on and on. You kind of lay out all these things that this misdiagnosis of ADHD could be. Before you even call it ADHD, look at all of these other areas that it could be. And I think that's the brilliance of what you did in your book, Mistaken for ADHD. Again, his name is Dr. Frank Barnhill. Visit his website, mistakenforadhd.com, and we'll have a link to his book in the show notes section at theliveinlowcarbshow.com/show notes. Well, Dr. Barnhill, thanks so much for joining us here today on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show.
It's been my pleasure, Jimmy. Thanks for having me.
Coming up next time on the Livin' La Vida Low Carb Show, we're going to talk about the Scandinavian LCHF movement that is happening with Dr. Andreas Einfeld from Sweden and Dr. Sophie Eksterberg from Norway.
Visit our website at thelivinlowcarbshow.com/show notes. And email us anytime at llvlcshow@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.